The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
We're now going to delve deeply into the world of Shavuot, the receiving of the Torah, specifically the issue of Naseh and Nishma, which I'll explain in a minute. And so we've been marching through Sinai. And we left Egypt. And we had this incredible experience, you know. A little nerve-wracking. God takes us out of Egypt. We think we're in a good space. Next thing we know, we're in front of the Red Sea. We got the sea in front of us, the Egyptian army behind us. Looks like there's no way out. Hashem finds a way out. So life is great. And now we're marching through the desert and we're counting our days, right? Sfirat HaOmer. And as much as we're counting each moment and appreciating the barley of life, we are still counting up, right? Otherwise there'd be a mitzvah to say today is a new day. That's not the mitzvah. The mitzvah is today is the 23rd day of the Omer. Today is the 24th day of the Omer, right? So we're getting somewhere. And in fact, on a mystical level, we are actually climbing rungs of the ladder, as it were, right? There are 49 levels of, actually 50, of impurity or purity, depending on what it is, okay? And again, if you're curious at some point, we can talk about this, but numbers in Judaism are very significant. The number 3 is significant, the number 7 is significant, the number 8 is significant, the number 40 is significant, right? And the number 50 is also significant, okay? And just a 30-second soundbite so that you kind of have this in your mind as we go into some studying. And I'm not talking about codes here. This is stuff that you just see in the verses everywhere you look. You don't need a computer for this. The number 6, generally, you know, Umberto Casuto, who's a biblical commentator, noticed at one point that numbers seem to repeat themselves. And he was fascinated by this. He's an Italian commentator. And Casuto, yeah. And much later commentator. Okay, this is not, he's not on, you know, the Visionist list of Gedolei Torah. He's more of a biblical commentator. You'd study him in university, but a brilliant, brilliant fellow. And I'm personally a big believer in sort of, you know, finding knowledge where you can find it and learning to filter it based on your own personal filters. Anyway, he noticed this stuff. And although he didn't know quite what to do with it, he catalogs where you see these different numbers. And it's really amazing to see what he does. The Sfat Emet, the Ger Rebbe, 120 years ago, he, on the other hand, not only noticed it, he started to do things with it. Now, he was a Mekubal, and I don't know how much his Hasidim at the time knew that he was a Mekubal. A Mekubal is a Kabbalist, right? If you go into certain neighborhoods in Yerushalayim and you say, I'm looking for a Kabbalist, they don't know what you're talking about. You have to ask for a Mekubal, right? And among other things. And just an incredibly brilliant Torah scholar. And among other things, he used to give Sichot, you know, Torah discussions on Shabbat, especially on Shabbos afternoon, and his Hasidim would be mesmerized. And later they would write up his notes, and he edited some of them, and this became known as the Sfas Emes, right? The Sfat Emet is the, I guess, the lips or the language of truth. And what's fascinating about his commentary, the Ger Rebbe, is that until about 5 years ago, you had to be brilliant just to try to follow it. Because he just naturally assumed, because he was talking to his Hasidim in, you know, in Poland, right, in Ger, Sadagora, he just naturally assumed that you know certain things. Like if he starts the line of a page of Talmud, well, you know that page of Talmud. He doesn't have to quote the whole Talmudic statement, right? Or if he quotes a Medrash. So everybody knows the Medrash, right? So he doesn't have to quote the whole Medrash. So he'll just say, like it says, you know, and he'll quote the first four words of the Medrash, right? And then he'll go on and just like it says in the verse, you know, Vatan lava tichsaf. And you know, that happens to be from Yirmiyahu, but you don't, you know. So you're reading this paragraph, and it's got like a line, and then another line, and another line. You know what he's talking about. You know, because he'll say, you know, Shishim ribu malachim yardu, right? And that refers to the Talmudic discussion of when angels came down and crowned the Jewish people. If you don't know that, you know what he's talking about. So when I first started studying Sfas Emes, it was an incredible amount of work, because you would take a paragraph, and then you'd have to look for where these things were, right? And there were no footnotes. So you'd have to either figure it out or ask around or find it in other books or eventually come across it. And I had like, you know, on my desk, I had like, 16 different pieces of Sfas Emes that I was like waiting to find this one. And sometimes I come across it and I'm like, ah, That's in that Tfas Emes. Then I'd mark it. Then eventually I'd get one where I knew all the different pieces, and then I would sit down and try to figure it out. And then I realized how difficult it really was. In fact, any sefer on the Tfas Emes that you will ever read, any commentary on the Tfas Emes, always begins with a preamble. I hope that Hashem has blessed me to understand to some degree what the Tfas Emes says, but of course we don't really know what the Tfas Emes is talking about, so, you know, this is just as best as we can do. And that's not some humble, that's really true. But anyway, he noticed these things, and some of what he says you can figure out. So as an example, the number 6 is always incomplete. Okay, always. Okay, the number 6 is always incomplete. You will never find that 6 is a completion of anything. And it's basically incomplete in the world of nature. For example, God creates the world in 6 days. Okay, and if you look at the end of the 6 days, it says, Vayara Elokim et kol asher asa v'hineh tov me'od, and God saw everything that he had done, and it was very good. You know, God was patting himself on the back, right? It's a difficult question, but not for now, right? And the Catholic world, actually, when they first printed the Bible, they assumed that that was the end of creation. And that's why, in the Catholic version of the Bible, that's where chapter 1 ends. But in Judaism, that's not at all where creation ends, right? Because after that it says, you know, Vayechal Elokim et kol asher asa, right? Bayom HaShvi, on the 7th day, God completed all that he did. So what did God do on the 7th day, right? On the 7th day, God created Shabbat. So the 7th day is the completion of the 6 days of the week. And you find this all over the place, right? The land of Israel. So the land is supposed to be worked for 6 years. At the end of the 6th year, the land lies fallow. That doesn't mean that you finished at the end of the 6th year. That means the completion of our relationship with the earth is the Shemitah, the sabbatical year, when we don't farm the land. And you find this in many, many places. Now, 8. So 6 is incomplete. 7 is completion within nature. 8, on the other hand, is what the Tfas Emes calls me'ala teva u'me'ala zman, above nature and above time. And this is like not just from the Tfas Emes. This goes way back. The Bahir talks all over. Kabbalah talks about this. The Gemara talks about this. Right? So 8 is above nature and above time. For example, the festival of Sukkot, which we're going to study. The festival of Sukkot is a 7-day festival. And then there's an 8th day. And the 8th day is called Shmini Atzeret, the 8th day festival. And that's a separate festival. It has its own sacrifices. It has its own liturgy. Today, overseas, they celebrate this, you know, also as Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah, the celebration of Torah, right? We dance with the Torah scrolls. Because that's above, right? The 8th day is the circumcision, right? When a baby boy actually enters into a covenant and becomes a Jew, right? Girls become Jewish much earlier. That's a whole other discussion, right? They get it quicker. It's been a nature of life, right? That's because once you've experienced a week, including one Shabbat, then you're above nature and above time, right? There are 8 different vestments that the priests wore. There are 8 different instruments that the Levites used in the temple. 8 is above nature and above time, okay? Now, 49, okay, is not just the number 7, which is complete. It's 7 times 7, okay? So that's completion on a national level. That's the perfection of perfection. And therefore, the 50th day is the day after 7 times 7. So whenever you see the number 50, there's a reason. For example, and God blessed Abraham, right? Hashem berachet Avram bakol. Avram was blessed with kol. What is kol? So kaf, in the numerical system, right? There's aleph, bet, gimel, dalet, hey, vav, zayin, chet, tet, yud. Those are the 10th letter, 10 letters. Then the next letter is chaf, and that is 20. Lamed, which is the letter after chaf, is 30. So the word kol, which is chaf and lamed, is 20 and 30, is 50. And therefore, Hashem blessed Avram with above, with beyond. And that's why when you look in the Medrash, when you look in rabbinic legends there, they start getting to all these discussions about Abraham experienced the world to come in this world. You don't understand where all this stuff is coming from, simply from that number. Okay? So bear this in mind, sort of in the back of your mind somewhere. Okay? Because we're going on this journey, and we're counting 7 days 7 times. Okay? And by the way, you may have noticed this when you, either when you say the Omer, if you're sort of into the Omer saying thing, in the Siddur, there are all these little additions there. You know, for example, there are 7 levels, what we call Sfirot, okay? And it's hard to define what these levels are, that's why I work with Rabbi Aaron, so he can have fun with that. But let's just assume for the moment, in addition to sort of 7 worlds, 7 layers, right, there are also 7 different characteristics of existence, of life. For example, the first one is chesed. Okay, chesed literally means loving kindness. But it's basically an outpouring of energy. Right? When you do kindness, you're giving out. You're putting out. In fact, when you put out too much kindness, right, you burn out, right? You only have so much energy to give, and you can waste away from all that you give, right? And that's chesed. Chesed is just living, loving, giving, right? Gvura, which literally means strength, which is the second level, that's actually almost the opposite of chesed. Whereas chesed is giving out, gvura is holding in or receiving. Okay? For example, Abraham, who was the first of the forefathers, he represented outgoing energy, and his whole life is about outgoing energy. He goes out and fights wars, he goes to Israel, he gets there, there's a famine, he goes to Egypt, he's finished with Egypt, he goes back to Israel. When he gets to Israel, he's going across the land, he's digging wells, he's fighting wars, all this external energy. Yitzhak, his son, on the other hand, we know very little about Yitzhak. Yitzhak is completely passive. Whereas Abraham is the okayed, the binder and the binding of Isaac, Yitzhak is the ne'akad, Yitzhak is the sacrifice. He's passive, he's gvura. He's the ability to receive, right? Whereas Abraham digs wells, Yitzchak never digs anything. He never does anything. He never leaves the land of Israel, right? He follows in the footsteps of his father Abraham. In fact, even the wells that he digs, the verses tell us, he re-digs up the wells that his father dug that somehow got stopped up by the Philistines. Okay? So whereas Abraham is that outpouring of energy, that new excitement of an idea, Yitzchak is the challenge of carrying that initial germ of an idea into fruition, of making it work. Abraham has this brilliant idea, he sits up all night, he's writing an idea for a thesis, he's so excited, he's been struggling to find the thesis, and he finally finds it, and he sits down all night and he's excited. Yitzchak's the one who has to sit down and do all the research and spend a year getting to know it all. Okay? And that's gvura, that's internal energy. Yaakov, on the other hand, Yaakov is Tiferet. That's the third level. Tiferet is literally means beauty. Now, what is beauty? What does it mean to be beautiful? You ever wonder about this? Right? I see a girl walking down the street. I think she's beautiful. And you see the same girl walking down the street, and you think she's beautiful. And when we sit down at the table, you know, we'll say, that was really a beautiful girl, a beautiful child, a beautiful painting. And there's some things just you all agree on. What makes something beautiful to the extent that people will agree on it? So I'll give you an example. Let's say one day I discover the technology to create a human being. And I decide that I want to make super teacher. That's what I want to do. I want to make somebody who's such an incredible teacher that he or she, you know, I don't think there are enough women teachers. That's an interesting dilemma that we have today, right? So we're going to make a woman teacher, and she's going to be the most amazing woman teacher ever in the history of the world. So one of the details that I would personally think is that if a person is good looking and charismatic, they walk into a room and they have the ability to get places that take other people more well. So I would make this woman beautiful, right? So how would you make it beautiful? So I'm walking down the street one day and I see a woman with blue eyes and I think, wow, that's great. Blue eyes, beautiful blue eyes. So I give this woman, I figure I'll give her blue eyes. But then the next day I see a woman and she has olive green beautiful eyes and I figure, oh, that's beautiful too. So you know what? I'll give her one blue eye and one olive green eye. And then I see a woman and she's got like, you know, olive complexion skin and that's beautiful. But then I see another one who has alabaster skin and I think that's beautiful. So I'll make half her alabaster and half her olive skin, right? And pretty soon she's got one short arm and one long arm and one short, right? And she doesn't look beautiful. She looks fakak, right? She looks ridiculous. Beauty is in the balance. Beauty is symmetry. In fact, an idea becomes beautiful, right? When it balances things. It's like if you look at a piece of Torah, right? I'll tell you how I learned Torah. Just, this is my personal relationship. You don't have to do it this way. There's a commentator called the Abarbanel, Dan Yitzchak Abarbanel, and I fell in love with this commentator because this is really the way he does it. He looks at a section, and he just rips it to shreds and starts to ask questions. He says, well, this is the first question, this is the second question, this is the third. And he'll come up with 20, 30 questions on a given section. And then he'll start to respond. And he won't respond by saying, this is the answer to the first question. This is the answer. He'll just give you one long response. And while he's responding, he'll say, by the way, this answers the first question. This answers the eighth question. This answers the second question. Right? In other words, what he's doing with, he's coming up with one response, which responds to all the questions. Right? If you think about it, yesterday when we were studying the Omer, we had all these different questions. What makes something beautiful is that you have one idea, and it deals with all the issues. That's beauty. You know, when I see a truth, you know, I remember once I was talking with a student who had come here. You know, some people, they come very excited. I never used the board. I'm going to use the board. This is big, right? Okay, what's this? This is like America, okay. All right, and what's this?
Israel.
Yerushalayim, there you go. Okay, and this is America, and that's Yerushalayim. Now, here's the issue, okay? Some people, they have to get from here to here. And they figure out that all they have to do is go this way. Some people, they got to go all the way around the world. This was one of my all the way around the worlders. She had been to Nepal and India and Tibet and China. She was searching for truth, right? And she was actually in, she was in India and she was studying with a Maharishi for like a year. And finally this Maharishi tells her, she's studying like, you know, whatever, Buddhism. And Maharishi tells her, you know, Buddhism can water your tree, but it can never be your tree. You must go to Jerusalem to find your tree, right? That's what she tells me. And I didn't know that I had an Israelite recruitment center in India. And that's why she came here, is what she told us, right? You know, some people go all the way around. So we're sitting down one night, and, you know, we're discussing this. And she's kind of sharing with me some of the beauty that she discovered in Buddhism, which is beautiful. And I'm sharing with her, you know, some of the beauty that I know of Judaism. And I say, no, that's really amazing stuff you're telling me because I see that in Judaism. So she looks at me like I'm an idiot. She says, well, truth is truth. Like, if something's true, you're going to see it in all sorts of different places. And that's true. That's beauty. That's Tiferet. Okay? And as you go up these rungs, in other words, I just want to give you a basic idea before we get to the meat of our topic. They weren't just walking along like it took a 49-day trip. I mean, in fact, if you look at the map, you have difficulty figuring out why it took them 49 days. I mean, my toddler could walk in less than 49 days, the distance that they walk. They were taking a journey. And the act of appreciating each day, you know, there's a danger in appreciating each day. Because if you appreciate each day, and you're so content with that day, that you want tomorrow to be just like today, then you've got a serious problem. You see, nothing in life stands still. This is a very important idea. Nothing in life stands still. You're either moving forward, or you're moving backwards. Okay? This is true in every discipline in life. Okay? Do you, Melissa, do you take any, like, after-school activities, you know, ballet, anything like that? No? Pardon? 5 hours of homework. Ooh, we have to have a discussion about this. You let me know what I can do for you, okay? 5 hours. Right? Okay. So, okay. Got to come to Israel, man. They don't have that much homework. Of course, they don't have Sundays, but, you know, it's a balance. But anyway, so imagine for the moment, just imagine for the moment that you're taking, if you had an after-school activity that you could take, what would it be? Aren't you glad you came here today? What would it be? Pardon? Gymnastics. Excellent. Okay, gymnastics. All right. So one of my kids is into gymnastics. All right. And I didn't realize when you send your children to gymnastics that you actually need heart medicine while you take this. Because your kids come home, Yair comes home, and he's like, hey, watch this. I can do a flip, right? And he runs towards the living room, and he flips upside down, lands in the living room, and my wife and I are like, that's not a good idea. Right? And they do these things. You know, Yonatan's in Taekwondo now. He's learning to do a backwards Anunach Vesish. He wanted to show me in the kitchen. I'm like, no, that's okay, right? So if you start gymnastics, karate, any of these things, right, the first day, they'll tell you something to do, and then they'll say, go home and practice this. And you'll come back a week later, and the teacher will take one look at you, and will know whether you practiced or not. If you practiced, you're further along. If you didn't practice, you're further behind. Because by the end of that hour class, you had gotten somewhere. But if you didn't practice all week, you've moved backwards. You're not where you left off, right? Now, if you look at a master gymnast, an Olympic gymnast, right, or a black belt in karate who didn't practice this morning, you won't be able to tell the difference. You'll feel he's just where he was yesterday, but he'll be able to tell the difference. You're never standing still. Baryshnikov used to say that if he didn't practice one day, he could feel the difference in his technique, right? You're never standing still. So the omer, the goal has to be, right? Now, in order to figure out how life works, right? There are two things you need to do. The second thing you need to do is you need to figure out where you want to go. But the first thing you need to do is you need to figure out where you are. Now this is very important. And people don't appreciate how important this is. And I'll give you a great example. When I was in yeshiva, okay, I went to Gush, and I grew up traditional, like I told you. And I knew a little bit about how to learn, but I hadn't fallen in love with learning. I hadn't. You know, I was finished high school, you know, I was going to services, you know, minyan every morning, and I was studying Talmud in the morning and math and science in the afternoon and whatever else, and I came to the conclusion, I got to decide, if I don't love doing this, I'm not going to spend my life doing this. So I figured I'd give it a chance, and I went to Israel for a year to study in yeshiva. And the truth is, I got really into it, you know, and I actually fell in love with the learning, because I took a date with learning, right? And at a certain point, I was in what I call the yeshiva psychotic state, okay? I was going to be super Jew, right? I was waking up in the morning for Vatikin, right? Which is, you know, prayer with sunrise, which in the summer is like 3, 4 in the morning, right? And, you know, the yeshiva day is a very difficult day. The guys wake up at 6, they pray at 6:30, they do a little learning for breakfast. By 8:30, they're back in the study hall. They learn until 1. They study from 1. They eat lunch at 1. Then they have a break, but, you know, the holier-than-thou ones, we go back to the base medrash and study till 3. Then you have afternoon service. Then you have the afternoon study session. And you study or take classes until 7:15. Then you have dinner. Then you pray the evening service, right? And then you come back to the base medrash to the study hall from about 8:30 till 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. And if you're super Jew, then you stay till 1, 2 in the morning, right? And that's what I was doing. And I figured by the end of the day, I was learning 16 hours a day, easy, 18 hours a day. You know, and I was collapsing into bed at like 1:30 in the morning, and then I'd wake up at 3:34, right? And on top of all this, you know, I was running and getting ready for the army, whatever it was, right? And on Shabbos, I would just crash. And the truth is, as challenging as it was awesome, because now, you know, in life later, I can sit for 8 hours and do anything just because of that experience. And I thought, this is unbelievable, right? I'm learning 16 hours a day. And then I picked up a Musar Sefer, a book of Jewish ethics, or Rizal Salanter, and he makes this point. He says, before you decide how to grow in life, because if you're not growing, you're dying, right? Figure out where you are. And one of his examples was, like, figure out how many hours a day you're learning. And then you can decide what to shoot for, right? So I thought, okay, that'd be cool. So I decided for a week to keep a record of how much I was learning every day. Only I decided to do it honestly. Like, if you're in the base medrash, but you take a break to get a Coke, and then you run into a friend, and you get into discussion because, you know, Michael Jordan just pulled the most amazing move, and that's important to analyze, and whatever else it was, right? So I didn't keep that on the list. And if I got a phone call, so I didn't keep that on the list, and et cetera, et cetera. And I actually discovered that netto, the total time of learning that I was learning, on average a day, was about 6.5 hours. Do you understand this? I was sitting in the base medrash for 16 hours a day. I was actually learning about 6.5 hours. So that blew my mind. And that really blew my mind. I said, you know, this is crazy. I'm going to sleep at like 1:30 in the morning, waking up at 4, I'm going to get sick. And I'm not really learning 16 hours a day. I'd be better off going to sleep at 10:30 at night, waking up at 6, right? Taking the break to do whatever I need, but making sure that when I'm in the base medrash, I'm really learning. And then I'll up my productivity to 10 hours a day. And so I tried this for a month, and it was unbelievable, right? So you have to know where you are in order to figure out where you're going. And then you have to be sure that the direction you're headed in is the right direction, because your eyes are moving up or moving down. That's also part of the challenge of the Omer. So I'm building my way up. And if you remember the first few moments that we were studying together, I pointed out that Purim, right? Purim is really the preparation for Pesach. Because there's a Gemara that says, Shloshim yom lifnei achag dorshin et achag, 30 days before the festival, we start to explore the festival. So I'll tell you just an interesting thing. Okay? What is 30 days before Shavuot? Do you know what 30 days before Shavuot is? This is unbelievable. Okay, 6th of Sivan is Shavuot. The 5th of Sivan, therefore, is the eve of Shavuot. What is 30 days before Shavuot? Anybody want to take a guess? What's the month before Sivan? Anybody know? Iyar, good. What's the 5th day of Iyar? That's Independence Day. The birth of the State of Israel is 30 days before Shavuot. Now, I don't personally believe that's an accident. In fact, what's amazing about that is really it was supposed to be the 6th day of Iyar. But like I told you yesterday, they moved it up a day because people started going nuts because it was Shabbat. Okay? The Independence Day, Yom HaTzma'ut, is the beginning of the preparation for Shavuot. But we're not there yet. That is one of the biggest challenges of the State of Israel. There are so many people who thought we were there. And now I think pretty much everybody's realized we were not there. And we're not there yet. And by the way, just as an aside, in terms of those Sfirot, in terms of those levels, do you know what the 5th day of Iyar is? The 5th day of Iyar is Yesod Shebetiferet. Yesod is the foundation, it's the basis. It's the things in life, it's the ability to be grounded. Tiferet is balance. The birth of the State of Israel was the opportunity, the potential, to bring Tiferet, to bring beauty and balance into the world. Because the Jewish people had been in exile for 2,000 years, and that was an imbalance. There was something off with that. Because if we're meant to be a role model, if we're meant to be a light, you can't be a light and a role model if you're persecuted all over the world. We were finally about to begin our journey into the rediscovery of balance. Okay? And I want you to bear this in mind as we get into Shavuot. Now we can talk about Shavuot. Any questions so far? Okay. So now we can talk about Shavuot. I got an interesting question for Shavuot. What are we celebrating? I mean, Shavuot is a celebration, right? What are we celebrating and how do we celebrate it? So pick which one you want to respond to and let me hear what you think. What are we celebrating And how do we celebrate it? Anybody? On Shavuot, on the festival of Shavuot, okay? Does anybody know what happened on Shavuot? We got the Torah, right? Well, that's an interesting question. Did we get the Torah? That's an interesting question. Did we get the Torah? Now let's think about this. The sixth day of Sivan, or maybe it's the seventh, it's not quite clear, but okay, we'll put that aside for the moment. What actually happened physically? We'll get to see this in a minute, we're going to study something, but what actually happened on Shavuot? People kind of gloss over this, you know, you go into synagogue, the rabbi gets up, today we are celebrating the receiving of the Torah. I always thought someone in the back should say, excuse me, I'm not so sure, right? What actually happened on Shavuot? Moshe climbed up to Mount Sinai. Okay? Now, don't get me wrong. There's a humongous sound and light show. Right? 3 days they're preparing for this event. Somehow, they see sound. Vayir'u kol amata kolot. I don't even know what that means. They hear the voice of God. In fact, the voice of God is so intense, they can't handle it. After two commandments, they're like, whoa, you know what, Mo? We would really love to hear this from you. We can't deal with this, right? Okay? But that was the day that they got the Ten Commandments. And then what happens? Moshe's up in Mount Sinai, right? And he's like looking down the mountain, and he's basically like, see ya, wouldn't want to be ya, right? You know, that's it. He's up there for 40 days, he disappears. Now we know that because Moshe disappears, and because they get confused with the dates, something pretty negative results in this experience, which is, anybody? The sin of the golden calf. Okay, 40 days later, less than 6 weeks, after talking to God, hearing God, seeing God, listening to the Ten Commandments, the Jewish people are in a massive orgy at the foot of Mount Sinai of idolatry. Okay? Not really a great day in Jewish history. As a matter of fact, right, next week we're going to commemorate the day that we made this mistake of the sin of the golden calf, right? Because the anniversary of that day, some 3,200 years later, is the 17th day of Tammuz. And this is one of the most infamous days in Jewish history. It is not coincidentally the day that the Roman legions broke through the walls. If you were sitting in this place on the 17th of Tammuz in July, in the year 70, the thunder of the battering rams would have stopped, and the Roman legions poured through the walls, actually right below here. Okay? So this is not a good day. You know? So, and there were all sorts of other things that happened on that day. The Talmud describes five of them. So let me get this straight. Okay? You meet a girl, you get married. You know, I have someone that I'm very close with who was married, and he ended up getting divorced. And it's a longer story, but it was actually, there's a reason that there's a mitzvah to get a divorce. Sometimes it's just not meant to be. You know, and my attitude, I think the Jewish attitude is, you know, before you let a marriage go, you really have to explore it. And I remember I'm very close with this person, so I flew all the way to America, and I sat up with him till 4 in the morning. By the end of our discussion, I said to him, you know what, you guys don't have kids, you need to get a divorce. You just didn't know what you were getting yourself into. This girl needs a lot of therapy, and whatever it might be, and you need to get a divorce. And it was very challenging for me because I was close with them, and because they just seemed, I mean, she's such a great person. She is. And thank God she's remarried, he's remarried, whatever, and they got a divorce. Right? And he, for 3 years, went back to being a single, not in Manhattan, very challenging. And, but he got it together and found what he was looking for, and now he's married, and they just had their fourth kid, and he's in heaven, Baruch Hashem. He lives here in Israel, right? So, I can't imagine calling him up on the anniversary of his first wedding and saying, by the way, big day today, huh? And he'd say, excuse me? Oh yeah, this was that first wedding. You know, we had a good time that night, didn't we? You know, click, right? I mean, it's just, but that's what we're doing. We had this big show. We went up. Okay, Moshe disappears. We get a divorce. Now, we don't really get a divorce, it's a separation, granted. But, you know, the marriage ketubah, right? The luchot, the tablets, they are not exactly framed. They are thrown down the mountain and broken into little pieces. And then we go through this whole process of you know, of rapprochement, which we're going to talk about this afternoon. And then finally we go up and we get a second set of tablets. And we come down and we have those tablets. And that's great. And in fact, that's one of the difficult questions, because we're going to see what date that is and what we do on that day. And that's even more bizarre. Why am I celebrating this day? That's number one. Number two, think about, did we really get the Torah on this day? Okay? When does Moshe go up? He goes up in the book of Exodus. Okay? And if you were looking at a book, which is the five books of Moses, right? So the portion, that's a good one, this is where he goes up. And this is what's left. So we didn't finish getting the Torah. We're not even close to it. In fact, what's Moshe doing up there for 40 days? What does that mean? He's what? He's getting the Torah. So if he's getting the Torah for 40 days, why am I celebrating the first day? Pardon? Oh, very good. I could not have asked for a better intro to what we're going to talk to. So I want to thank you. You'll get your check in the mail later, okay? What that means is one of two things. Either it means that we really didn't get the Torah. We just started the process of getting the Torah. Or, which I think is a little more appropriate, the beginning of getting the Torah is about acceptance. Now think about our discussion yesterday. Okay? You thought that that was a tangent. That wasn't a tangent. We just needed to have that in our under our belt in order to get to today. Right? If the essence of the beginning of a relationship is the development of trust, what is trust? I told you yesterday that love is all about giving. Right? So what is trust? Trust is all about receiving. Okay? It's like, I remember at one of our Israelite retreats, right? We run these retreats for like 3, 4, 5 days, plug, plug, plug. And one of the things, we sometimes, if we can find the right campsite, so they have these ropes games. You ever play these ropes games, right? And there's one piece of the game, okay, where you basically stand on a pylon. And how we do this, because, you know, we get a very wide variety of students, just kind of like this room, so we got to do it so that, you know, whoever's doing the catching can do the catching, and whoever's doing the catching feels comfortable about catching in terms of opposite sex, whatever. So this is lots of fun. And, you know, we get these ropes instructors. We give them all these rules about how we can work, and I think we confuse them. But anyway, we finally get it together. And basically what happens is, and I did this, you stand up on the pylon, right? And they say, okay, you have to fall back perfectly straight. And there's a group of people that you've never met before. Now, you happen to have managed to give them one class. So you're about to find out if they like the class or not, right? And you just kind of fall back, and they have to catch you. Okay? Now, that's about trust. Right? Trust is the ability to completely put yourselves into someone else's hands. And the goal, and I don't know, we might get to this during the course of this week, I don't know if we're capable of completely getting there in this world. But at least the goal, in other words, knowing what your goal is doesn't mean you're ever going to get there. Right? You know, like being an ethical person, that's the goal. You can't wake up one day and say, I have arrived at being an ethical person, because if you have, then you're probably arrogant and you've still got a lot of work to do, right? So at least you want to know where you want to try to get to. The goal is to completely put yourselves in someone else's hand. To so trust someone, to be so one with someone, right, that you're in their hands completely. By the way, life is about experiences that Hashem gives us and then takes away so we can achieve them on our own. Right? We're in the desert. We're totally in God's hands, whether we like it or not. Then we go into the land of Israel, and now we have to do that on our own. We have to conquer the land and do it on our own. Man is created, according to the rabbis, as an androgynous being, male and female. Okay? If you look at the verse, it says, "Vayitzer Hashem Elokim et Adam, Zachar Nekeva bara otam." And God formed man. Adam does not mean man or woman. This is one of the, the failings of the English language. In the English language, there's man and there's woman, and that's it. In Judaism, in Hebrew, there's Ish, Isha, and Adam. Adam really means man and woman. Okay? That's why whenever you see the word Adam, it refers to men and women. Right? Adam ki yamut ba'oel. If a man falls, if a person dies in a tent, and then you become impure from death, it doesn't make a difference whether it's a man or a woman. Ish, on the other hand, refers to man, and Isha refers to woman. And that's very important, because if you look at the letters of Ish and Isha, right? So, this is Ish, which means man, right? And this is Isha. Now you're discovering why I don't like to use the word, which means woman. Now in English, you know, there's this whole sort of feminist attack on the word woman, because it's kind of like, you know, we're the man minus or the man plus, right? Or the man with the womb. And, you know, some people don't like that, whatever it is, right? In Judaism, we have two common letters, okay? We have two common letters. The Aleph, sorry, that's why I don't like to, okay, you get it. The Aleph, right, and the Shin, okay? And then we have two letters, right, that are in common. And that's the Yud and the hey. Okay? And that's because if you have those two letters common, that's the name of God. If there's God in a relationship, then it becomes very deep, very beautiful, very special. But if you take God out of the equation, all you're left with is Aish, which is fire, destruction, right? Okay? So ultimately, we were originally created as one. And then it says, Vayomer Elokim lo tov hayota Adam vado. It's not good that we have Adam alone, because there shouldn't be a being that's alone. There should be partnership and other. And therefore, right, God puts Adam to sleep. And when Adam wakes up, he's Ish. And he discovers Isha. And that's why what he exclaims is, right, Etzem me'atzamai uvasar mibseri, right, Lezoti karei Isha, ki me'ish luka chazot. She is Isha, I am Ish. Okay? So what really happened there was that we were once one. And then we undergo this mystical thing called nisira, right? Separation. Right? So why did God make us as one if we were only going to become separate? Other. Why didn't God do it right the first time? And you see this question all over the Torah. Right? God puts us in the Garden of Eden. And he tells us not to eat from the tree. Okay? And of course we eat from the tree because, right? Because we're human beings. That's what we do. Right? And we go and we eat from the tree. And what's the consequence of eating from the tree? We get kicked out of the Garden of Eden. Okay? So God knows we're going to get kicked out of the Garden of Eden, right? So why did God put the tree there in the first place? Why did God put us, it's almost as though God put us in the Briot, God put us in the Garden of Eden in order that we should leave the Garden of Eden. And that makes a lot of sense because we needed to experience the oneness with God in the Garden of Eden, but then we need to leave in order to explore it, discover it, find it, earn it on our own. Okay, we experience the love of oneness, what it means to be one with a woman. And then we're separated, but now we yearn to find that again. The natural yearning that a human being has to discover other and to become one with that other has its root in the spiritual yearning we have to be one with God. And you see this everywhere you look. Okay? So, Moshe's there, and then Moshe disappears. Alright? And the beginning of the ability, the start of becoming one, is the ability to trust, to receive, to develop a relationship. That's really what we're celebrating on Shavuot. Now, having said that, and by the way, that's why, if you think about it, on Pesach we asked this yesterday, on Pesach we eat matzah, but on Shavuot, the sacrifice is the two whole loaves of bread. Because that's what Shavuot is about. Shavuot is the celebration of our willingness to receive those two tablets. Right? Which represent partnership. The bread God gives us from heaven, and the bread we're willing to earn on earth. And the ability to put them both together. And by the way, that's the reason that this is the essence of the beginning of Shabbat. We take the two loaves of bread. Now, I don't know if you ever noticed this before, but if you look at the Nusach, at the language, on Friday night, we say V'yanu Chuva, right? And we rest in her. On Shabbat morning, we say V'yanu Chuvo, and we rest in him. And on Shabbat afternoon, we say V'yanu Chuvam, and we rest in them, right? On Friday night, the Hasidic custom is that you take the two chalot and you put one on top of the other. That seems like such a negative thing. Why am I putting one on top of the other? Why don't we both be together? Okay? And then I run my knife across the two challahs, okay? But I actually eat the bottom one. Cut the bottom one. On Shabbat morning, I do the same thing, but I eat the top one. And at the third meal, and many people don't know this, but you're really supposed to have lechem mishneh. You're supposed to have two loaves of bread for the third meal as well, two rolls, right? And then you cut them both, you eat them both. That's why we like the third meal, right? And that's about balance and about partnership. And that's the whole goal of Shavuot. So now that we've said all that, okay, now we can take a look, okay, at this naaseh v'nishma, this experience of receiving. So here's what I want to do, okay? I'm going to give you two pages. Okay? But I'm going to start with the first one. Why don't you take 10 minutes to study this, okay? I'm going to give you a second page. The one that I give you second is the second page. I didn't get a chance to write, oh yes I did, I wrote number 2 on the second page, I didn't write number 1 on the first page, okay? And what I want you to do is, this is a section, okay, that is the point at which, at the beginning of Yitro, okay, God tells Moshe to come up on the mountain, and the Jewish people are ready to receive. However, you will notice, for those of you with a little traditional background, that something's a little off, because there's something missing here. If you don't notice this, that's fine. Okay? Because you're not supposed to notice it when you read this, because you're supposed to read this before you know that. But Some of us are not so lucky, okay? And then I'm going to give you a second page, which I think will help you with the first page. Right. Right. He goes up. Well, it's a big, big, big debate. And I debated actually doing this piece with you and decided not to. The choreography of Moshe up and down. God tells him to come up. Then your next thing to know, God tells him to come up again. Then he tells Moshe to go down. Then Moshe is down, but now he's talking as though he's up. It's very confusing, Moshe up and down. That's a whole discussion of how that works. But essentially, on a pshat level, Moshe goes up on the 7th of Sivan. He comes down on the 17th of Tammuz, breaks the tablets. Now he has to go up and get forgiveness. Right? So there's a couple days where he's, you know, dealing with the golden calf. He goes up again on the 20th day of Tammuz. He comes down again on the 30th day of Av, which is really the beginning of Elul, Rosh Chodesh Elul. And that's why the beginning of the month of Elul is the beginning of forgiveness, because that's when we're forgiven. That's the second 40 days. Then he goes back a third time to write the second tablets, and he comes down 40 days after the new month of Elul, which is Yom Kippur. But don't worry about memorizing this, because we're going to talk about this this afternoon. I'm going to write it on the board. Okay? Cool? So don't sweat. Okay. If you're in the middle of a really good discussion, and you're like a little annoyed that we don't have enough time to do this, I look forward to inviting you back for the full year program, God willing, one day. But until then, if it's challenging to pull yourself out of a discussion, that's good. That's the way Torah should be, like I told you yesterday. Okay. So let me hear what you got. This is a complicated question. First of all, just so I know where we're at, how many people managed to also look at the second page I gave out? Okay, so some of us got there. Okay, cool. I don't think that means that you completely covered the first page. That's okay, but you got a sense. All right. So let me hear what the questions are, okay, before we... And what I need you to do when you do this kind of question thing is, if you're going to ask me from a verse, quote the verse. Look at the verse so that everybody else can follow along, all right? So, let me hear. Let's take 5 minutes to look at questions. Yeah?
First of all, why the need for intermediaries at all? Why?
Ooh. Ooh. Do you hear that? We've got this whole paradigm... We've got this whole paradigm, now I know why she married you. We've got this whole paradigm of Moshe has to go up on the mountain to get the Torah. Why do I need Moshe? By the way, if we didn't have Moshe, if we didn't have the need for Moshe, and we weren't waiting for Moshe, what would never have happened? Pardon? The sin of the golden calf. So you say, well, Moshe had to take them out of Egypt. Well, why did Moshe have to take them out of Egypt? Hello? Here's God. Okay, here's God. Alright? And here's the Jewish people. Okay? And they're in Egypt. And we want to get them to Israel. So what do we do? Well, we got to get 10 plagues, and we got to split the sea, and then we take them to Mount Sinai, and then they got to wander for 40 years because they mess up. Right? And then we finally get them to Israel. Right? Well, how about this? I'm God. I want to take the Jewish people out of Egypt. Here's a little Torah. And you're done. What's the whole deal there? Okay, what else? Yes.
I was going to answer that.
No, no answers. Just questions. Go ahead. Ooh, what's the difference between Bet Yaakov and Bet Yisrael? And, by the way, pardon? Good. It says, Kotomar leBet Yaakov, v'tagid leBnei Yisrael. In fact, it's very interesting. The commentators notice this, and they talk about the Amirah, is a much softer form, right? And there's one opinion that says that God is speaking to the women and to the men differently, and one opinion is that God is first giving them the communication from a woman's perspective and then a man's perspective, but there's certainly a difference. Good. Now, I want you to know, by the way, just so we're clear, I mean, I could, just a little bit that I know, we could sit here for 3 hours just to look at the questions here. We're not going to get to all the questions, and we're certainly not going to get to all the answers. But noting the questions is good. Because one of the goals, if you remember, that I had here, was that the next time you get to Shavuot, or, and we purposely pick topics here that are universal. I mean, this is about receiving Torah in your life. This is about revelation. This is about everything. So you can pick any time. You know, you want to get a group together. I mean, you're in Florida or Brooklyn or wherever, you know, and you want to do something, so you get a group of friends together, you say, let's do some studying. So they look at you like you're nuts, right? Because, well, which rabbi is going to speak? No, we're just going to study. So now they're really curious. So you bring this along, and you photostat it, and you've got the basis for a discussion, and that's an amazing discussion. What is the difference between Yaakov and Yisrael? Yaakov was the name Yaakov has before he goes through a certain process and a struggle in his life. Yisrael is the name that he takes on afterwards. Yisrael, Sar El, means that you're a prince. A Sar is a prince. Yaakov, from the word Akev, is the name that Yaakov is given because he's holding on to the Akev, to the heel of Esav when he's born. Yaakov is the downtrodden. Yisrael is the prince. Why is God giving us the Torah and speaking to us as the downtrodden and as the prince? That's a whole day's seminar, just right there. Okay? So that's food for thought. What else? What else? Yes. We're going to find balance here, right? Yes. Well, let's think about that for a minute. Look at verse 7. Pasuk Zayin, verse 7. Okay, Vayavo Moshe Vayikra L'Ziknei Ha'am. First of all, who is Moshe talking to? This is a mistake we make. Yeah, I'm good. Okay, this is a mistake we make. Moshe, we have this image that Moshe comes and teaches the children of Israel. That's not exactly true. If you look very carefully in the Torah, you will find Moshe does not teach the Jewish people. Moshe teaches the elders. Okay, Moshe teaches Yeshua. Moshe teaches maybe Nadav and Avihu and Elazar and Itamar, the sons of Aaron. Okay, who is actually the Rebbe, the teacher of the entire Jewish people? Nope. Aram. Now, I never really understood this until I went to yeshiva. Okay, when I went to yeshiva, I went to a place called Gush. And there were actually two Rosh Yeshiva in Gush. There were two heads of the yeshiva. It was an incredible experience just to watch two Torah giants run an institution as a partnership and how they got along. In fact, personally, that's the model for me in terms of Israelite. You can't imagine how many opportunities you get to start your own thing. There's something very special about being able to work with someone like Rabbi Aaron, where you're partners and you're so different and you complement each other. But the model for me of doing that was when I went to yeshiva. And, you know, I mean, I don't want anybody to make the mistake of thinking I'm comparing, because these are giants of men, right? Rav Lichtenstein is like a walking Torah scroll. There's just no other way to define him. His mind is so brilliant that you can't really fathom what he has to say. Okay? And I remember especially when I was in first year, when I first went to yeshiva, so once a week there would be a shir klali, there was a general class for the whole yeshiva. And you couldn't go to his regular classes because you weren't on that level yet. You were a first year student. But once a week there was a class and he would give to the whole yeshiva. And you would spend, it was on Tuesday afternoons after mincha. And you would get this list of things to prepare. It was like a long list, you know. Might as well have just said, why don't you go through the Talmud, right? It was just unbelievable. And pages in this tractate and that tractate and here and there and verses and Rambam and different medieval commentators, the Ramban and the Rashbah and the Rif and the Rush and the Ran, whatever. And you're reading all this stuff, and then you're reading all this stuff, you don't know what to do with it. Like, why is he giving me this stuff? You're trying to figure out what the issues are. And you can't even understand at the beginning, you know, what these people are saying. Like, what's the Ramban saying? I mean, you know, I'll give you 4 pages, I mean, just so you understand, you know, especially when you get there and you're right after 12th grade. Like, he'll tell you to look up, you know, something like, you know, like this. And he'll just say, you know, read these 4 columns. Right? You know. As one of like 40 different sources, right? And then you would sit in this class, and I remember like 10 minutes into the class, and I'm there, and I'm with my pen, and I'm ready to write, and no idea what's flying. No idea what's flying. Might as well be listening to an advanced calculus or biophysics class. And I remember after about 6 months of this, I went to my older chavruta, a guy I was learning with, who today is a Ram, he's a Rebbe in the yeshiva, Mordechai Friedman, and I said to him, look, you know, I go every week, I spend the morning preparing, I sit in the class in the afternoon, and I still don't know what's going on. You know, like I might figure out, you know, sort of a couple things here and there, but I don't know what's flying. Maybe I'm better off spending this day learning something and doing something else instead of just wasting a day. So he, I'll never forget this. He puts his hand on my shoulder. He goes like this. He goes, Shana Aleph. It's okay. He walks away. I'm like, what do I do with that, right? So anyway, I decided to stick it out till the end of the year. Stuck it out till the end of the year. At the end of a whole year, I finally was able to start following most of his class. It took me till halfway through the second year that I could really start to understand his class, be able to predict it. And only after I came back from the army and I'd been in yeshiva 4 or 5 years, I actually went to his regular, you know, 3 times a week Gemara shiur. At which point I thought this is going to be no sweat because now I can follow his class. I went in there and we started from scratch. I had no idea what was flying. Right? And you sit there and after a while you start to make a breakthrough because you start to realize how his mind works. You know, and he speaks. I mean, I would go to this teacher's degree program in behavioral, you'd study like behavioral dynamics and class, you know, methodology and behavioral psychology and all these different, how to interest a class and how to motivate a class and how to work with a class and all these different things. Then you'd go sit in Rav Lichtenstein's chair. And he'd basically break all the rules you just learned in the morning. You know, he'd sit there at a table, right, and he'd have all these books open. And he'd go, we'll now discuss
14th page, there are four different opinions here, according to Rashi, Ramban, the Rambam, and the Rif. Rashi is expecting us to understand as follows, but of course that doesn't really work right. And that's how he talks for 3 hours. For 3 hours. On Friday night he gives a sicha in Parshas, I'm going to hell, this is being reported. But on Friday night he gives like a weekly portion discussion, right? And when he finishes, right, it's like a 45, you know, like the rabbi gets up in the synagogue Friday night to share a thought, he does it for 45 minutes. I have never brought Israelite students to Gush on a Friday night because I know they're just like, what am I doing here, right? And in fact, when he finishes, so they always take 2-3 minutes before they start the evening service because all the guys who fell asleep have to go and wash their hands, you know, that's how bad it is. Most of them. And it took me years to be able to follow this because then you can't even write notes. But when you make that breakthrough and you get to that point, unbelievable. It is just unbelievable. In fact, I look back at some of my notes when I was in the first year of yeshiva, and you see like there's a description of like a Talmud, and then it goes, I can see where I fell asleep, right? And I think to myself, and now I go back and I look back at those notes, and I'm like, oh, that's such an amazing question. I can't believe I don't know what he said, right? And you get to the point, he takes a tractate, and he rips apart the text, and he finds the central question. And then he builds a map of all the different commentaries and how each one comes to that question from a different perspective and how they're consistent with their opinions in other tractates. And it's unbelievable. And he keeps this whole map of like 40 different opinions and perspective in place. You know? And never mind that once you can do that and you learn how to do that, it affects your whole life because you can start to think like that. You can keep all these different things in your head. He's training you to do this. It's incredible. And if I would go to yeshiva and sit with a class like that right now. So for me to sit with him for 3 hours and to listen to his shiurim, which I try to do a few times a year, I'm in heaven. It's just heaven. And I'm sitting next to a guy who's there in his first year, and he's in hell. Right? And that was Moshe. Moshe's the Rav. Moshe speaks to the elite. If you're going to learn Torah from Moshe, you have to be willing to work for it. He only speaks to the zkenim, to the elders. Look at this verse. He's speaking to the Zekenei Yisrael, to the elders, to those who have mastered already, to have gotten to a certain level. And I once asked Rav Lichtenstein about this. I said, you know, you have 500 guys here. Isn't there a way to make 500, you know? It's not what he's interested in. He's interested in producing leadership. He's interested in finding an elite. He wants you to sweat for it and to struggle for it. And it's worth the journey if you're willing to take it. And it doesn't mean you're so special. I don't want you to get this wrong. If you would go and you would sit for X number of years, you would get there. It's a question of whether you want to do that. And that's what he's looking for. That's Moshe. Moshe's the Rav. Now Aaron is a whole different paradigm. When Moshe's up on Mount Sinai talking to God, where's Aaron? Aaron's down below. He's with the people. He's in the muck. Aaron is known as the Ohev Shalom and the Rodef Shalom. He pursues peace. He loves peace. If you want, by the way, to read an incredible article on this topic, Rav Soloveitchik has a magnificent article. It's reprinted in English in a book called Reflections of the Rav by Rav Moshe Bezdin. I have it at home. If somebody wants it, let me know. I'll be glad to bring it in and photostat it for you. It's an amazing article. And Rav Soloveitchik contends that there are two models in Jewish leadership. There is the Rav and there is the Rebbe. And we need the Rav. We need the Rav, that leader, that giant of Torah, that Talmudic mind that most people can't fathom, who can speak to the leadership and develop leadership on an intellectual level, who can raise that leadership up to a certain level, a personality that we can be in awe of. You know, I was just having a discussion with a friend of mine who's a principal of a high school in Efrat. And he's an amazing guy. And his name is Shlomo Kimchi, whatever, and he's the principal at the high school where I might decide to send my son in a year. So we're having this whole discussion, and I asked him, when do the tests for the beginning of, you know, the Mifchanei Knesa, the beginning of, sort of getting into high school? So they have the tests, and the kids get their answers as to when they're getting into high school by Hanukkah, which is December. So I said to him, that's terrible. Why do they do it so early? Like, what happens to an eighth grade kid when he already knows he's gotten into high school? Psh, right? There goes Torah out the window. I said, why don't they do it like later in the year? Why waste the year? So he said to me, he said, look, I would do this in a second. I've been trying to get this done, but some of the other high schools in our area are high schools, they're artsy high schools. They accept students from all over the country. And if they do it later, then these kids will have been accepted already into good schools elsewhere, right? And they won't wait. So they won't be able to get the right kids. And so they're stuck.
So I said to him, well, so why don't the high schools in this area get together with the best high schools from around and make a decision? He said, He said, you know what, in the ultra-Orthodox world, I don't like the labels, but for the purpose of this example, one of the Torah leaders who recently passed away a couple years ago, but a giant, Rav Shach figured this out one day. So Rav Shach basically walked into Beis Medrash in Panovich, banged on the shtender, and said to all the yeshivot, he wrote a letter, to all the yeshivot, we will not talk about next year until after Pesach. There will be no entrance exams, there will be no responses, there will be no decisions, there will be no interviews. Children need to learn Torah. Until they finish Pesach, nobody talks about next year, and that was it. That was it. By the end of the day, these high schools had all changed their policies. We don't have a Rav Shach. You know, the National Religious Camp doesn't have a Torah leader of that level, and you need that. You need that. It's a big problem. But there's something else you need. There's something else you need, and that is the Aaron. You see, Aaron, you know, the Rav, he teaches the elders, and therefore the simple Jew has no one to talk to. The Pashto Yid, the simple guy, he couldn't go up to Moshe Rabbeinu and talk to him, because he didn't need a rabbi that he could meet who was giving the intellectual three-hour discussion. He needs somebody who can meet him on the basketball court. He needs somebody he can sit down with and talk to about his life. That's very hard to do. I mean, it took me a long time to develop a relationship with the Lichtenstein because he's a very shy person. And he's not the kind of guy who comes over and says, hey, Benzer, how's it going? He just doesn't do that. You know, you go up and stand there for him, and he'll just read his book. Yes. Right? You know? That was warm. You know, like, you gotta... It's a longer story. But in any event, we need the Aaron. And if you want to know, by the way, just as an aside, okay, this is an unabashed plug, if you want to know what Israelites' mission par excellence is, it is to find a way to help to develop these leaders. Because they are missing in the Jewish people in a big way. That's why we do this Rabbinic Enrichment Fellowship. And that's sitting right here at the beginning of Torah. And I want you to understand why it's worth the while to take this 5-minute digression. Because the beginning of your journey into a relationship with Torah is to find that Rebbe. You know? The Mishnah in Pirkei Avot says, Aseh lecha Rav, make for yourself a Rav. It does not say, choose a Rav. It does not say, listen to a Rav. It does not say, learn from a Rav. It says, make a Rav. You have to find one. You have to develop a relationship with him. It's not the job of the teacher to develop a relationship with you. It's just not realistic. And this room is a perfect example, right? How many teachers are in this program? And how many students are in this program? Statistically speaking, you know, you will not develop a close relationship with students unless they're willing to run after you. It's a terrible thing. And I want you to know, it's almost embarrassing. It is. It's embarrassing, and most teachers, like I always speak for myself, are uncomfortable with it. You know what? The student should have to run after you. It's uncomfortable. But it is the fact of life. And there's some people in this room who will hound you, right? And that's why you have a relationship with them. And the truth is that a good teacher loves that. You do. I mean, I can only speak for myself. I love it when students are willing. I feel bad that they have to email me again and again and call me. But that's what you have to do, and it's no big deal to do it here. The big challenge is wherever you go back to, there is someone there, maybe hidden, who gives the occasional class. He may not be a rabbi, by the way. He may be just a guy who knows a lot of Torah who gives a class in his office. You have to be willing to find him. That is worthwhile. Okay? So let's see. What other questions? Give me a couple more questions, and then I got an idea for you. Yes? Oh, isn't that interesting? It says, very good. We do this all the time, right? We're so busy getting there, we miss the question right at the beginning. It says, Bachodesh HaShlishi, in the third month. What would I have expected? I would have expected it to say on the fifth day, on the second day, on the first day. It just tells me it's in the third month. Okay? So I can't resist. I'll give you a quick idea, because this is really valuable to be aware of, because this is the introduction to receiving Torah. So that means this is important. Okay? So I mentioned to you before that numbers are significant. One of the significant numbers is 3. 3 is a very significant number. It's actually the first significant number. Okay? At least in our world. Obviously, 1. I mean, every number is significant because Hashem created it all, but fine. Right? Why is the number 3 significant? This is a big day. We're using the board a lot. Okay? If you make 2 points, it doesn't matter where you make them. There'll always be a line, right? Anywhere I make them. But as soon as I make a third point, then each point becomes significant. Right? Because if I put the point here, it's a totally different shape. Right? So 3 is significant. The other reason that 3 is significant, and you find 3 all over the place. For example, in order to move forward, you need 3. Right? A bet din, a court. Why do you have 3? Because if you have 3, you bring different opinions to the table, but you can reach a conclusion. If you only have 2 and they argue, you're stuck. Right? And that's why at the beginning, right? You start with three avot, three forefathers. And those represent much more than three individuals. They represent three stages, chesed, gvura, right? And tiferet, and the balance. And every life experience, this is a longer discussion, Rav Dessler talks about this, the Michtav Meleahu, every life experience has three components, it has three pieces, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. The beginning is that outward energy, the excitement of a new idea, I don't know, the beginning of life, the creation of life is a moment, right? It's an enormous outpouring of energy, a man meets a woman and fertilizes her, right? But it's a moment. And then you have gvura, then you have this long drawn out process to take that initial moment and to bring it to fruition, gestation, pregnancy, the writing of the doctoral thesis, and then you have tiferet, birth. In fact, it's interesting that in tiferet, in the third stage, in that stage of synthesis, where chesed, outpouring energy, and gvura, internal energy, the initial idea, the long process of pregnancy, gestation, and writing, whatever you choose to call it, come to fruition, right? That's a very intense time. In fact, usually right before you get there, it looks as though you're going to lose it all. I mean, if you came across a woman who was in labor and you didn't know what labor was, you would think she was dying. Except for, thank God, for epidurals, right? But okay, right? And then the next minute, when it just seems like all is lost, the next minute a baby's born, and it all comes together. Right? And by the way, the Jewish people is like that. Just before the state of Israel was born, it looked like we were finished. That's not an accident. Right? So, the Torah comes in the third month. It doesn't tell me a date because it's the third month that's important here. That's how I see it. Right? This state of Tiferet, this balance between me and God, between beginnings and gestation, between the work that I've put in, you know, sometimes you arrive at a Yaakov. You know, you arrive at Tiferet, you think you found, I don't know, you meet a girl. And you're all excited, you go on this great date, you come home, this is the one. Right? The next morning you say, let's get married. So why do people get nervous? Why do they get nervous? That could be. The reason they get nervous is because they're nervous maybe there wasn't a Yitzchak. You ever read a book that had an Avram and a Yaakov and not a Yitzchak? Guy has a great idea, he sits down and starts writing a book. He finishes the book by the next morning. He's got a book. But he didn't go through the long process of making it into a book, and that's exactly what the book reads like. Right? It reads like a piece of trash, because he didn't put in a Yitzchak. Right? And sometimes relationships are like that. You have an Avram, you got the Yaakov, but you didn't really put in a Yitzchak, so you don't really have Yaakov. So that's why it says you have to be in the Chodesh HaShlishi, you have to be in the third month, you have to have gotten there. You have to have captured that idea, you have to have put in the work, and that's why it's 7 weeks that it takes us to get there. Okay? Let me ask you one question, because I don't want to run out of time and I want to get to this idea. There's this amazing line. It is the epitome of the receiving of the Torah that everybody quotes. And if you knew of this line, you probably got a little surprised that it didn't seem to be there. Okay? And that is, anybody? Anybody? No? Okay. It didn't seem to be there on the first page, right? Na'aseh v'nishma. This is a fascinating line. What does na'aseh v'nishma mean? Na'aseh v'nishma means that when we received the Torah, that God said to us, are you willing to accept my Torah? And we said, Naaseh, let us do, v'nishma, and we will listen. Okay? And that's an incredible line. In fact, it's such an incredible line that the Gemara, the Talmud, in Shabbat, in Tractate Shabbat, says, Darash Rabbi, this is in Daf Pechet Amar Aleph, the 88th folio, Darash Rabbi Simai, which I think is really Simlai, B'sha'ashik dimu Yisrael naaseh v'nishma, when the Jewish people said first, we will do, and then we will listen. In other words, normally you come along, you know, and I say, listen, I have an idea for you. You say, okay, I'm willing to hear it. Right? And then, you know, you're willing to hear it. You say, okay, I'm in. But the Jewish people, they trusted God. They said, you know what? Whatever you say, we'll just do it. So that's unbelievable. They didn't need to go back and forth. So, b'sha'ah, at the moment that the Jewish people first said, na'aseh, we will do, and then said, nishma, ba'u shishim ribu shel malachei hasharet, 60,000 or 600,000 angels came down from heaven, l'kol echad v'echad m'Yisrael, and came to each Jew, kashru lo shnei k'tarim, they tied on for him two crowns, echad k'neged na'aseh v'echad k'neged nishma. One versus doing and one versus listening. Right? Unbelievable. And the Gemara goes on to say, right, b'sha'a shekdimu Yisrael na'aseh nishma, yatzta bat kol, a heavenly voice came out, v'amalen, mi gila lebanai razeh, who told my children this tremendous secret that the angels use? That's very interesting. Why is this such a tremendous secret? Why is it such a tremendous secret? And I'll tell you my biggest problem with this secret is that when you really stop to think about it, It doesn't make sense. I mean, God tells the Jewish people, you know what? Imagine that you're going into a business partnership. Not an easy thing to look for a business partner. And you finally find someone you think is really solid. But it's a complicated business idea. It's a life journey. You know, you're making a big decision. So your lawyers get together with his lawyers, they spend a lot of time, and they come up with a contract. I mean a Gesunter contract, you know? Okay? And you get together, you're going to sign the contract, and you show up, you say, listen, you know, my lawyers drew this up. It's a long contract. You'll read it. You'll go through it. Let's be sure we're both on the same page. And then hopefully we'll make a decision and we'll get together, right? And you put that down on the table, and it sounds just like that, right? So this new guy, this business partner, he looks at this and he says, phew. Oh, I'll tell you what. You know what? I don't need to read this. Where's the page? Show me. I'll sign it. Let's just do this. So what would you feel? You'd feel that this guy was an idiot. Because he's not even reading the contract. And you might have just written in there that 96% of the profits go to you. In fact, you'd probably be very nervous about doing business with this guy. Rabbeinu Yonah asked this question, right? The Mishnah that I gave you on the last page, right? What does it say? It says that there are two parts to what we accomplish in this world. Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa says, this is in Pirkei Avot, right? Kol shirat cheto kodemet l'chachmato, chachmato mitkayemet. Right? V'kol shachachmato kodemet l'yirat cheto, ein chachmato mitkayemet. Okay, so that's the balance between sort of the awe of mistakes, and we're going to get to that this afternoon. Right? But he adds something else. Kol shemaasav mirubin mechachmato, chachmato mitkayemet. If your actions are greater than your wisdom, then that's good. But if your wisdom is greater than your actions, then that's no good. And in fact, the Mishnah goes on to say, Lo midrash ha'ikar ala ma'aseh. The main thing is what you do, it's not what you study. So basically, first we should do, and then worry about study. But that makes no sense. That makes no sense. Says Rabbeinu Yonah, how can you abrogate your intellectual capacity? You need to understand what it is you're going to do. First of all, practically you need to understand. You know, I get the Torah says you're going to put tefillin on. I don't care, I don't need to learn it. Whatever you say. Yeah, but what's tefillin? How are you going to know what to do if you don't study? And second of all, just as a healthy attitude, you need to know what you're accepting. Are you ready for this? Can you handle this? You know? I mean, I get very nervous. A person walks into to yeshiva, right? And we use a stereotype. He's got like earrings come out of every orifice and tattoos, you know, I love babe and whatever it is. And the next thing you know, they whisk him out. 2 hours later, he's got a black hat and a long coat, right? And he's not even walking. He's gone like this because he really wants to get into it, right? And he's going straight to the wall to accept God in his life. So I don't know about you, that makes me very nervous. You know, because that's a beautiful Yaakov. I mean, I don't define my Yaakov by the coat, but let's assume that the inside is like the outside. But and he had an Avram, obviously. But where was Yitzchak there? Makes me very nervous. Sit down. I get very excited when a student comes in to my office and sits like this. All right. You know, what is all this stuff? Like, I'm willing to come for a week and see if there's anything to this. That makes sense to me. So what is Na'aseh v'Nishma? We're going to do? Do what? What's the point? So says Rav Avigdor Nevenzel, and I think this is very true, and if we had more time we could get into this. You see, ultimately it depends on who's writing the contract. You see, if I give you a contract and you don't know me, then yeah, you'd be silly not to take a look at the contract. But if I give my son a contract, if I give Yonatan a contract and I say, listen, then, this is 30 pages, this is going to govern our relationship in learning Torah for the summer. I want you to sign this. I don't think he'd read it. If my dad gave me a contract, and he said, listen, we don't have time, but the Chafetz Chaim believes you should always have a contract, we do business together, so I wrote up a contract for us. I would read the contract. I would say, well, let me read it. What a chutzpah. My father? If my father wrote a contract for me, I would sign it. That'd be it. Because there's nothing more important to my father than that I should be happy. So if that's true about my father, how much more is that true about Hashem? Which brings me back to where we started. Ultimately, Na'aseh v'Nishma is magnificent, not because of the process, which makes no sense. It's precisely because the process makes no sense that it demonstrates that you begin with trust. And that is the celebration of Shavuot. I celebrate Shavuot because on Shavuot I made a decision that I am willing to trust that there is something greater than me. This is a very difficult thing for a human being to do. And we'll end with this thought. Rav Elchanan Wasserman has a magnificent question. Rav Elchanan Wasserman was one of the great rabbis of the last generation. He was murdered in Kovno, and he was very close with the Chofetz Chaim. When he was in the Kovno ghetto, he gave a series of lectures. And these lectures were basically sort of, I guess, dealing with the issues of the day. And he's famous for his Kovetz Chidushim. He has a collection of magnificent, brilliant insights into the Talmud, into the Rambam. What's less known is that there's a small volume that was published posthumously after the war called the Kovetz Ma'amarim. It's a selection of articles. I don't think it's ever been translated. It's only published in Hebrew. It's out of print. You can get it in the Gush Library. And one of the articles he has there asks a very interesting question. He says, the first mitzvah of the Rambam, the first mitzvah, the first commandment that the Rambam Maimonides lists in his book of mitzvot, is mitzvah dolad mod leidash yesh amaloa. There's a mitzvah to know that God exists. There's a mitzvah to know that God exists. In fact, his source for this mitzvah is Anochi Hashem Elokecha, God says, I am God, beginning of the Ten Commandments. First mitzvah, I want you to know I exist. So the Chana Wasman says, well, that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. What kind of a mitzvah is that? Belief is not a commandment, it's a psychological state. If you know that Hashem exists, then you don't need the mitzvah, right? You know, I don't have to command you, I don't know, to love your husband, because you wouldn't be married if you didn't know you love the husband, right? So if you're already there, right? You're already there, right? Then you don't need the mitzvah. And if you're not there, then what's the point of the mitzvah? Well, because I command you, you're going to believe in God? So if Avraham Wasserman, to make a long story short, says, no. And by the way, you have to understand, he's dealing with this with his students in the Kovno ghetto. I mean, this was the issue of the day. How can I believe in God? So Rav Chanan says, it can't be that we're given a mitzvah that we can't all fulfill. And since you can't be commanded to believe in God, it must be that we already know that God exists. Everybody knows that God exists. How could you not know that God exists? Look at the world. Not everybody knows that God exists. That's because there's something that prevents them from knowing that God exists. And the way he defines this is that what prevents a person from accepting Hashem into their life is control. Because if Hashem exists, now either Hashem exists or Hashem doesn't exist. Hashem doesn't stop existing because we don't see that Hashem exists. So from my perspective, this doesn't have to be the perspective, but from my perspective, if I'm looking at why someone doesn't accept Hashem in their life, it can't be because Hashem doesn't exist, because I believe Hashem exists. So there must be some other way to look at it. So it says Rav Chanan Wasserman, who doesn't believe God exists, he knows God exists, Rav Chanan says it can't be that God doesn't exist. So how could it be that if Hashem exists, somebody doesn't accept that Hashem exists? Because in order to accept that Hashem exists, you have to be able to let go. That's a very hard thing to do. See, if Hashem exists, then I don't run the world. Then I'm not really in control. And that's a very hard thing to do. And if you want to know the single greatest reason that people have difficulty in their lives, in every sphere, it's the inability to let go on some level. It could be the insignificant detail, like the fact that you want your desk neat and she keeps dumping stuff there, right? It could be larger issues, you know, like which school we choose for our children, or why he keeps showing up late to dates, or who knows what. And it could be the largest of issues, which is how could there be pain and suffering in my life? If I really understand that we don't have control over anything in this world but the way we look at the world, then even the challenging situations in our lives, they don't undermine who we are. Because I know I'm not in control. So there's one more thing I'm not in control of. But if I really believe that I can be in control, then every time something comes to demonstrate that that's not true, it undermines everything. That is the beginning of everything. The beginning of everything is the ability to let go. Now, be careful here. Letting go doesn't mean not doing. It doesn't mean not achieving. It doesn't mean that we aren't responsible for being in a partnership with God. That's why it starts in the third month. But it means, even though Hashem wants me to be his partner, I have to recognize that once I've done everything I can do, right, I can look back on it as an illusion. And we'll get to that, because that's the festival of Sukkot. Okay, so that's a little bit of food for thought in terms of Shavuot. We've taken the journey. We've welcomed the Russia to the table, the wicked son to the table. We're looking for oneness. Okay, we're willing to get Egypt out of ourselves in order for Hashem to take us out of our Egypt. Right? We've taken our journey to appreciate the barley of life through the desert, and now we've arrived at Sinai, and we're basically saying to God, all this barley that you're giving us, I know that I'm totally in your hands. And that's a celebration, and it's interesting. We don't have big parties on Shavuot. We don't dance with the Torah on Shavuot. That's going to come much later on Sunday. Right? What we do on Shavuot is we spend all night learning Torah. That's unbelievable. Now that we've done the Naaseh, we're willing to do, we still want to learn. If you don't get to the Nishma, if you don't get to understanding it, you've missed the boat. And God willing, we'll get to that this afternoon.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.